Great. Thanks, Mike. So welcome, everyone. My name is Melissa Winters, and I'm a member of EPA Region 10's RCRA Lead Region team here in Seattle, Washington. And it's my pleasure to introduce to you the RCRA Expert Brown Bag webinar series. So this series is an effort to capture and share RCRA institutional knowledge and expertise within the EPA and with our state partners. Webinars are offered live on CLUIN, and then they're also recorded for future viewing. So in this series, RCRA experts talk about how they know what they know. So speakers will cover what their topic is and why it is important, their keys to success, what are some key pieces of advice and lessons learned, their go-to resources, tips on best resources such as guidance documents and training for the topic area, and finally, a case study or example application, giving one or more real-life examples that help explain the topic's importance and illustrate the keys to success. So today we're really lucky to have Jim O'Leary presenting The Art of Rulemaking, and I just wanted to tell you a little bit about Jim, although I think many of you probably know him already. Jim has been at the EPA since 1980, holding various management and non-supervisory positions, primarily with the Office of Solid Waste, which is now the Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery. Currently, he is a senior program analyst with the Materials Recovery and Waste Management Division, where he develops rules and policies related to hazardous waste generation, waste determinations, and recycling. So as Mike mentioned, there will be time for questions at the end, but you don't have to wait until the end to type them in. So when you have a question, just go ahead to feel free to type it into the question box there as we go along. If it's possible for you to provide the slide number, that helps us to group them together, but go ahead and ask your question even if you can't do that. So before I hand it over to Jim and get started, we'd like to get a sense of our audience today. So Mike has put up a poll question there that if you could take a second to respond to, that will help us. How many years of experience do you have in developing RCRA rules? And the answers there are none, no experience, less than 2 years, 2 to 5 years, 5 to 10 years, or more than 10 years. So if you want to just take a quick second and tell us a little bit about your background, that will help us understand who's with us, and then Jim can tailor his presentation. Okay, all right, so that looks like it. We can go ahead and take a look at it here. So it looks like the majority of respondent or people attending today have no experience developing RCRA rules. And then behind that, we have sort of an equal amount having either less than 2 years or more than 10 years. And then the rest, the sort of the minority somewhere in between. So with that, I'm going to go ahead without further delay and turn it over to Jim to start his presentation, The Art of Rulemaking.
Thanks, Melissa. Let me get set up here a second. Okay. So good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you're located. Before I begin, let me preface my presentation by stating that this is really a collaborative effort with other rule writers here in my office. While I've been involved in civil rulemakings over my career, what I've learned is that no two rulemakings are the same. First and foremost, the issues and problems are never the same. Second, the importance of the rule within the agency is often not the same, with some rulemakings relatively limited in scope, while others receive high visibility and may even involve the administrator. Third, some rules involve many program offices within the agency, while others may involve only one program office. We always have to have our Office of General Counsel involved as well in any rulemaking, but it depends, again, on the rulemaking in terms of how many program offices are going to be involved. Finally, the players or work group members are always different. Some join the work group because they like the project or the subject. Some join the work group because they have their own ideas or they'd like to see to be implemented. And still others join because they have to. They have to represent a particular office or a region. Therefore, in developing this presentation, I reached out to my colleagues to capture their thoughts and observations and hopefully provide a better understanding of rulemakings and the art that goes into developing a rule. So let me go on to the next slide here. So I'm not sure to what extent the audience has written rules or been involved in rulemakings, although based on that survey, it looks like at least half have never been involved in rulemaking. So hopefully this presentation will be informative. And for those that have, I saw there's a bunch that also have lots of experience. Hopefully this is a refresher, as well as hopefully you can jump in too and maybe throw in your own thoughts and comments on the art of rulemaking. So what I would like to do is accomplish today is first provide some background and context by discussing why rulemakings are necessary, including describing the differences between rules and guidances, provide a quick overview of the processes involved in writing a rule, why it takes so long to develop a rule, and present a case study which you may find interesting and further understand why it takes so long to promulgate a rule. From there, I'll transition into the heart of this presentation and discuss the art of rulemaking, or how one goes about developing a successful or effective rule, at least what my colleagues and I here in headquarters consider successful. Then I'll quickly describe that no matter what the best rule written, there's a bunch of other activities you can't ignore, nor just be aware of the fact that there are externalities that you also can't control too. So finally, I'll close with some final thoughts here on what we consider to be the bottom line. Okay. So, here's a quiz for you guys, okay? And I think, Melissa, we can work this thing out. But here's a question for you in terms of, so what do you think is the most important component of any rulemaking? And I've listed 8 things down here, okay? And I'm going to read them to you, okay? First of all, how about defining the problem? Is that an important component of the rule? How about diverse and experienced work group? A vested work group? Being organized? Is identifying and sticking to milestones, et cetera? Support from your management, staying out of the public eye, all of the above, and then how about none of the above, just being in the right place at the right time. Okay, and so I think we're going to do a little survey here, and then we're going to come back at the end in terms of what you talked about, what you thought was the answer, and we'll go from there, and I'll give you my thoughts in terms of what the answer might be. So I am going to, if we could, I'm going to go on to the next slide, unless you need more time. Okay. So I know people are answering the question, but I'm going to move on, and we'll come back to it later on in terms of what people think. Okay, part one. So let's begin with the definition of a rule or regulation. Okay, this comes from a document I found on the web, but it's a pretty good definition here. The terms rule or regulation are often used interchangeably in discussions of the federal regulatory process. The Administrative Procedures Act, or the APA of 1946, defines a rule as the whole or part of an agency statement of general or particular applicability and future effect designed to implement, interpret, or prescribe law or policy. The process by which federal agencies develop, amend, or repeal rules is called rulemaking. So there's some sense there, okay, in terms of a pretty good definition, I think, okay? So why are rulemakings necessary? So there's 2 big reasons. First, because an environmental problem exists that cannot be otherwise addressed without promulgating a rule. And second, because the agency, through experience with implementing a regulatory program, has identified problems with existing regulations that require updating or modifying them. For instance, the Hazardous Waste Generator Improvements Rule that I've been working on for several years is an example where we lack the regulatory authority to address a particular problem through guidance, voluntary solutions, and a rule became necessary. So what triggers a rulemaking? First of all, it starts with Congress issuing a law or statute giving EPA the authority to write a rule or rules addressing particular problems. Without statutory authority, no rulemaking is possible. So Congress, as part of the appropriations process, can tell us to write a specific rule as well. Sometimes it's not what you know, but who you know, and a stakeholder can reach a congressman or a senator and get an add-on to a bill telling us to write a rule. Of course, they won't give us the money to write the rule, but that's another issue. I was involved in such a rule several years ago now, where a rulemaking was inserted as part of appropriations process. Then there's the courts. We can miss a statutory deadline, be sued or ordered to write a rule by such and such a date. We also can promulgate a rule, be sued and lose, requiring us to go back to the drawing board or stop trying. The definition of solid waste rule is an example where a few iterations of a rule were required, and we're still fighting litigation on the last go-around. Then there's the public and industry. They also have the right to petition us to address a problem that requires a rulemaking. 40 CFR 260.20 talks about any person being able to petition the administrator to modify or revoke any provision in the various parts of RCRA. The case study that I'm going to describe a little while actually started with started to some extent with a rulemaking petition. Finally, there's agency initiatives. They can be initiated by the administrator or actually by staff. As an example, the coal combustion rule was basically initiated by the administrator, and this is Administrator Jackson, at her confirmation hearing. If you remember, the walls of a service impoundment collapsed right around at the time of her hearing. This was at an electric utility, and it released millions of tons of coal combustion residue. I believe it went into it was released into the Tennessee River or some river in Tennessee. And basically, the administrator said she would address this problem, and it had to be done through a rulemaking. The hazardous waste generator improvements rule that I've been involved with actually started by staff level, and received enough interest at my management to initiate a rulemaking. So in both cases, you have the top down, you have bottoms up, and I guess it's all predicated on the problem in the situation. So let's talk about the differences between a rule, regulation, and guidance. Rulemakings require a very formalized set of procedures that must be followed. The agency has to follow all of the components of the APA or the Administrative Procedures Act, including public review, public comment, public response to every comment. Rules are enforceable. Facilities can be cited for violations and pay fines, or individuals can even be sent to jail when the violation is criminal in nature. Because of all the hoops that the agency has to go through, they are very time consuming, including public review and comment, and actually responding again to every comment submitted. Most rules receive thousands of comments. Rulemakings are also much more rigorous and involve estimating cost and benefits. They also involve engineering, scientific or science, risk assessments. It's pretty comprehensive. Regulations are considered a legislative rule. Now, a guidance is an agency's explanation of how it interprets an existing regulation or statute, and is not required to undergo the rulemaking process of the APA. It is considered an interpretive rule and does not have the force of law. Developing guidance is usually internal and does not involve public comment, but sometimes the scope is so comprehensive that public comment is necessary. The publication of the RCRA waste analysis plan that I think was done last year is an example where we sought public comment and involvement. Similarly, cost and benefits rarely, if ever, come into play in developing guidances. On to the next slide here. So what are the stages of the agency development process? Okay, by the very nature of rulemaking, reg writers have to follow detailed processes and procedures contained in what we call the agency development process. The agency development process contains five stages or components. Stage one involves determining the rulemaking's importance. The program office provides information describing the problem and the need for a regulation that is used to solicit the approval of the agency's regulatory policy officer to proceed with the rulemaking and to assign the action to one of three tiers based on the nature of the anticipated issues and the level of cross-agency interactions needed to ensure quality action. The first process is called commencement approval, and the second is called tiering. Stage two is basically developing the proposed rule or guidance that needs external review. Stage three involves OMB review for both proposed and final rules. if necessary. Most of the time, OMB wants to review rules, but sometimes it's not necessary. I developed a technical corrections rule several years ago and where OMB waived review because no costs were involved. As discussed later, though, OMB has a lot of clout in the review process. Stage four occurs after OMB review and involves coming down the home stretch here regarding the publication. This involves review and approval by the administrator's office, his or her signature, working with the Federal Register office to make sure we have followed all of their rules in terms of how rules must be written, and finally publication in the Federal Register. Then the fun really begins. We receive comments from our stakeholders, usually within 60 or 90 days after publication in the FR. And what we do is we repeat stages through to four again before we move on to stage five and develop the necessary information supporting the final action and responding to any congressional reviews. Okay, next slide here. Okay. So why does it take so long to promulgate a rule?
Oh, hey, Jim, could you actually define OMB for folks that aren't familiar
I'm sorry.
With that entity?
Yes, the OMB is the Office of Management and Budget, and they are in the Executive Office of the President. Okay, does that help? I hope it does.
Thank you.
Okay. So again, why does it take so long to promulgate a rule? And right here, because it just does. It just does. And this is some of the reasons why. First of all, we have to collect information to define and understand the problems. That takes time in and of itself. Okay, then you have work group process deliberations, developing issue papers, identifying the options, working through the issues in terms of resolving the issues between work group members, trying to reach consensus. When you develop these issue papers, you have to consider the cost, the benefits, whether they're enforceable, what the legal defensibility is, implementation issues, what the outcome desired are, stakeholder reaction. All of these factor in terms of developing these issues and working through, you know, a course of action to follow or take. Then you have to develop the background materials, the preamble, and the regulatory text. That takes months. Then you have reviews. You know, you have several reviews of both of this document, the preamble and the regulatory text. And that's both of reviews of both the proposed rule and the final rule. And then once the program office has sort of completed it and gone through work group closure, then you have agency review and OMB review cycles. Once you get through that, you propose the rule in the Federal Register. You receive comments. Again, they can be thousands sometimes. And then you repeat the process again in terms of you review and evaluate the comments. And in effect, you go back to the drawing board. The work group starts again. You start identifying the issues that you have to go through, working up issue papers, going through the whole work group process and trying to get consensus. So it's iterative in nature. And then finally, when you get through that, and you get through work group closure, you get through the agency review process, you go on to OMB. You go through that review cycle, and then in the meantime, what you're doing when your rule is over at OMB, you're also developing what we call a response to comments document, which some of us are doing right now with respect to the hazardous waste generator improvements rule. And again, at least with respect to our office, we have a policy of responding to every comment. And so, as an example, with the hazardous waste generator rule, we received comments from over 230 organizations, but within those 230 organizations, we could have several to numerous, very numerous comments. So literally we're talking about responding to maybe 1,000 or 2 individual comments. It's a time-consuming process. It's no fun either. Okay, so let me move on here to what I hope is a lot of fun here, a case study. I want to talk about the solvent's wipes rule. Because I thought it would just be good to do, you know, to provide an example, okay? I chose this rule as an example because not only was I involved from beginning to end in one capacity or another on this rule, because it demonstrates all the problems and challenges that the rulemaking process can encounter, and even more, okay?
It's not a typical rulemaking, however.
It's not a typical rulemaking, but it gives you all the soup to nuts, I guess you could say. So let me just say that sort of the trigger mechanism to some extent of this rule was the agency's effort to basically, it was part of the Common Sense Initiative. It was initiated in 1994 by the administrator, where this is Administrator Browner, and she wanted to develop clearer, cheaper, and smarter rules. Okay, and so she established six sectors, okay, to work through problems. The sectors were metal finishing and plating, automobile manufacturing, computers and electronics, iron and steel, petroleum refining, and printing. I was asked to cover the RCRA program on the printing sector initiative. And so I love to tell a story. So off I went to the first meeting of the printing CSI. The administrator was there. We were in a downtown Washington, D.C. hotel, big room. We had all of the key players from the printing industry. We had newspapers there. We had trade associations. We had big printers. We had little printers. And so the administrator went around the room asking each of the people at the table what they thought the problems were. And for the most part, it was mostly air issues that they wanted to cover. Okay, a few people talked about water issues, but not one of the folks at the table talked about RCRA issues. So there I sat after a few hours in terms of, so what do I do? So there's no RCRA issues. I can go back home and just call it quits and just say there are no RCRA issues with printers. But I chose to do my due diligence. And so what I did was at the break, I started talking to the members at the table in terms of newspapers, trade associations, actual printers. And the first thing they said was, you have to deal with solvent wipes. And so it was like a consensus in terms of, would you please consider solvent wipes? So off I went back to my office, and I told them, you know, what had occurred. And I suppose the rest is history, because, you know, my office chose to participate with the CSI and the printing sector initiative, and we chose to basically work on developing a solvent wipes rule. So with that, let me just move on here, just give a little more background here. So here's examples of industrial wipes. There's three pictures up here. On the upper left-hand side are what we call the reusable wipes, okay? They're used by industrial laundries. They're all standardized. By that I mean, you know, there's thousands of them. They come in different sizes, but they're cloths. Basically, once they become dirty, they're sent off to an industrial laundry where they're washed and returned to the in this case, printers. However, you know, there are many industries that use industrial wipes, so it's just not printers. So this rule was not just applicable to printers, but it was applicable to other sectors as well. So besides the reusables or the launderable wipes, you have the disposable wipes, and they come in two types. You have the standardized wipes, they are in containers. Each one contains, in these containers, they already contain the solvent. And so all you have to do is the worker just has to pluck out the wipe, and it contains a certain amount of solvent that they use to wipe a particular piece of equipment. And then in the lower hand part of the slide here, you have what we call rags, literally rags. I mean, they're shirts, they're sheets, and you have it's not a big industry, but you have people collecting these sheets and these shirts, and they reconfigure them. They rip them up, and they size them, and they sell them. And so we had people basically involved in the work group process, I guess you could say, who put in their two cents about who basically produced these wipes. By that I mean the rags, and sold them to industry. So hopefully this helps in terms of what we're talking about. So let me just stop the next slide here in terms of why does it take so long to develop a rule. And this is a humdinger, folks. So let me just start here, okay, and I'll go through this one by one. So I mentioned 1994 in terms of the CSI, but actually this rule to some extent goes back to 1985. Somewhere in the 1985-1987 time frame, Kimberly Clark and Scott Paper petitioned EPA to to exempt disposable wipes from hazardous waste regulation. And basically the argument was, look, there's so little solvent on these wipes that by the time the wipes get to the landfill, there's nothing on the wipes, so they pose no risk. And at that time, way back when, we were still involved with implementing the HISWA amendments. The HISWA amendments, or the Hazardous Solid Waste Amendments of 1984, at that time, it was the biggest, the most far-reaching statute to come into play here, or to become enacted by Congress. It had like 80-something provisions. And so we were involved at that time in implementing those 87 or 80-something provisions, and we really had no time to do a petition. And so, to be honest with you, I'm not sure whether the agency actually wrote a response to Kimberly-Clark and Scott paper. I never found one. But basically, we never, you know, we just didn't do anything in terms of literally responding to that petition. However, between 1991 and 1994, we did issue a policy statement deferring the issue to the regions and states. And basically what the policy said was for disposable wipes, you basically, you know, if you're using listed solvents, you have a hazardous waste on your hands, your wipes could be characteristic too, but in terms of disposable wipes, you're subject to RCRA regulations. When it came to disposables, we basically again deferred to the states, and what the states basically said was since it's being recycled, either these wipes were not solid and hazardous waste, okay, or if they were, they were solid waste and they were not subject to RCRA regulations. So in effect, they get a free pass. Although some states could be more stringent, but for the most part, if I remember, very few states were more stringent in terms of relative to the policy that we issued. And so if you think about it, you know, so here I am, I'm the disposable industry, and my wipes, because I'm using solvents or hazardous solvents on them, I'm subject to RCRA jurisdiction, I'm subject to RCRA regulation, but if I'm using reusable wipes, they're out of RCRA for the most part. If you think about it, you know, you have the issue of an unlevel or an uneven level playing field, and that is, you know, I'm subject to RCRA. For the laundrables, they're not subject to RCRA. And of course, you know, they had a bigger share, the laundrables had a bigger share of the market. So I mentioned the Common Sense Initiative. And if you notice here, a timeline within reason. I had 1996 down here. I was looking at this morning. I guess CSI began in 1994, but I don't think we really kicked into it until 1995 or 1996, for that time frame. But anyway, so we kick into the Common Sense Initiative. Okay, and then the fun begins. You know, as I said, we started developing a rule dealing with solvent wipes around this time frame. So between around the 1997, 1990 time frame, within reason, I started collecting data, going out, visiting sites, going out, visiting printers, other facilities that use solvent wipes, trying to understand the problems. At the same time, you have to understand that if we're going to basically deal with providing an exclusion or exemption from hazardous waste regulation, you have to show that there's no risk. And so I also got involved in risk model development. And you have to understand that this time, you have to understand that I was a team of one. I was doing this all by myself because we didn't have enough staff because they were busy with HISRA amendments. So I was basically involved doing the data gathering, doing the work group efforts, you know, doing outreach to stakeholders, having stakeholder meetings, and also coordinating in terms of risk model development. Usually you have a risk modeler on the work group helping me out, but we had nobody. And so I was basically working with the contractor in terms of developing the model, and I was using the in-house staff as consultants and throughout the whole process when it came to developing the risk model to see to what extent the risk were from disposing of solvent contaminated wipes in landfills. Once I had gathered all the data, developed the model, then I kicked into workgroup deliberations. That took a while. Again, to some extent, I the debate's a little confusing here, but basically the workgroup began earlier than 1999. I would say 1997, 1998, we started workgroup deliberations, but it really kicked in after I had the data, after I had the work, the risk model development and the numbers from the risk modeling in hand. So workgroup deliberation started, along that time frame. Also, here's a kicker. So in 2000 or thereabouts, we ran out of money. This effort ran out of money. And my office director said to me, we have these quarterly deadlines we have to meet. We have limited resources. This is relatively a lower priority relative to the quarter to deadlines and everything else we have to do. So, Jim, the only way you're going to be able to continue this effort is you're going to have to try and reach out and get funds from other offices. And so here I say, me and my tin cup. So I had two choices, either stop or proceed. And if I was going to proceed, I had to reach out to other offices. Well, I have been developing these relationships over the last few years and working with the air office and the water office and the toxics office and ORD. And so I went forward with my tin cup, and sure enough, they came through. And they were able to give me funds, enough so that we could continue. And then what happened was, I guess my office director felt guilty, because here's the air office, giving us money, the water office giving us money. So what she did was she reprogrammed some RCRA money also to keep the effort going. So anyway, it pays to know people in the right places, I guess you could say. In 2001, the agency peer review process begins. Now this again, here we are, it's 2001 or thereabouts, and we had developed this risk model. And so the issue became, do we go forward with the peer review process or don't we, right then and there, because we knew that the peer review process was going to be time consuming. What we elected to do was basically hold off and deal with it later on after the rule was proposed, because we had been at the rule for several years now. We just didn't want to delay it any longer, so we basically delayed the peer review process. I'm not sure it was a good idea. But anyway, here we go, 2002, 2003. Now, you have to understand something. I moved on after 2001. I basically took a detail in 2002, and again, I was the only one involved with this rulemaking. It was a team of one. And so before I moved on, I had to get somebody up to speed in terms of where the rule was, in terms of the process, and basically pass the baton. I also had to get him out there and see the real world in terms of taking him on site visits. So that, to some extent, took a while, but I moved on and did a detail, and somebody took over. So we basically proposed the rule in 2003. Okay, now in 2004 or thereabouts, the rule makes the front pages of the Washington Post, but for all the wrong reasons. This was a humdinger in terms of when we saw this in the front pages of the Washington Post. So the agency was accused of collaborating with the launderable industry, the reusables, in terms of helping them out, if you want to say. But basically what the Washington Post found, they found a correlation supposedly between every time we made a decision, the launderable industry would contribute money to the Republican committee. So it was like, what's going on here? So they basically accused us of being in cahoots with the launderable industry. And so all hell broke loose. We had a huge IG investigation. And it was, it was rather stressful, to say the least. It's nothing like being on the phone with the Washington Post explaining what you did and why you did it. So basically, we had to deal with an IG investigation that slowed us down for maybe a year and a half. Okay? So once we got over that hump and the IG found that, we were not in cahoots with anybody, we called it the way we saw it, we can move on. Okay? So we moved on with the process. So what happened is, we proposed the rule. And what happened was we got a lot of comments back in terms of the risk modeling effort had to be redone because the modeling was obsolete. Now, of course, I was the one involved in terms of helping develop the rule model. And at that time, way back, this is several years before, this was state-of-the-art rule modeling. You know, when I was working in conjunction with using our risk assessors here, they were pretty impressed with the risk model, and they said, this is really advancing the state of the art in terms of risk modeling. And so, you know, that really made me feel good, and I guess everybody else feel good in terms of this is great in terms of moving the ball forward in terms of risk modeling. But that was several years before, and basically, by the time, you know, the rule was proposed, which is several years later, there were so many advancements in rule modeling that it was basically obsolete. So we had to go back to the drawing board. And so here we go. We had to basically kick into the peer review process. And that takes time. We had to, and so that took, it almost took a few years to actually redo the model because, you know, of all the changes we had to make. Then we had to basically do a notice of proposed rulemaking, a notice of data availability on the new model. That was published with the new risk modeling results. You know, again, we had to review and modify the risk model based on those comments. Then we, you know, we resumed the work group process after all that was done and done, said and done, I'm sorry. In 2012, we had sent the rule over to OMB. The rule was delayed. I say don't ask me why. It was just delayed. It was delayed for over a year. This is just the nature of the beast in terms of rulemaking process. It can be delayed. Sometimes there's a reason for it. Sometimes it's not. It just was delayed for a long time. And then finally, in July 31st, 2013, we promulgated the rule. It appeared in the Federal Register. So if you look at that timeline, you know, of course, this is not your typical rule. So you can take your choice. You can go back to 1985. You can go back to 1994. But the point of the matter is, this was not your ordinary rulemaking process. But it had all of the ups and downs of a rule. So that's a taste of, I guess, of developing a rule. That is a case study anyway, if you want to call it that. So what are the takeaways from that rule, that case study? Okay, as I mentioned, a team of one. I was a team of one for the most part. And actually, after I passed the baton, and we passed the baton twice, we were, for the most part, a team of one. We just didn't have the horses to have more than one person on a team. And a team of one is not a team, basically, okay? It just doesn't work. And I think we've learned that through time, that you need more than one individual on a team in any rulemaking process. Again, turnover can be a killer. It just takes time to catch up to speed. It's nice to have management support. In fact, it's critical to have management support. Without it, I'm not sure what you do. They're able to move resources around, slow things down, move things forward. As an example, with the hazardous waste generator rule, my division director was able to move more resources in. And so, we're able to move the ball forward much more quickly. Just the whole idea of estimating time to complete. You know, I say here, estimate, you know, use a multiple of two or three. It's just the nature of the beast. It's just very time consuming. So if you think it's going to take a year, count on two or three. Another thing, know your own limitations. To some extent, when I was involved early on with the Silent Wife's Rule, they were calling me the Renaissance Man because I was doing everything. It's just the nature of the beast. But you have to know your own limitations. You have to know when to yell for help. You know that you're not an expert in risk modeling or in economic analysis. So don't be afraid to know your, and just, you know, ask for help. And again, realize you only control a smaller part of the process. Again, there's externalities involved, whether it be you're not so much your name, although my name did appear in the Washington Post, but seeing your rulemaking on the front pages of the Washington Post, that can be sort of, you know, stressful, time-consuming. Having to deal with OMB, there are just these externalities that sometimes you just can't control. Okay. Let's move on here. So let's just transition to here what we've talked about here in terms of the art of rulemaking, okay? We've talked about the why, the what, the when, and the who of the rulemaking process, but not the how, okay? And frankly, it's the how of the rulemaking process that will make or break you, okay? Surround yourself. Here we go, okay? So point one, in terms of how does one go about writing a successful rule? Point one, create a world-class work group team, or work group or team, okay? And here, surround yourself with work group members smarter than yourself, okay? And by that, I mean is that you only know so much. What you're trying to do, and it really pays, is to basically capture and reach out and get work group members who have knowledge and experience with the issues that you're involved with in that particular rule, who can assist in rule development in any way, shape, or form, in terms of whether it be in terms of helping you develop data, gather data, help you with developing issue papers. But what you want to do is basically surround yourself with as much experience as you can. Okay, then be proactive. Reach out and draft work group members interested in the rule. This is something that I try to do in all my work group efforts. Try to identify people who have an interest in this. If you're interested, they'll be vested in it. And if they're vested, you're going to get, you just get a much more better rule in terms of involvement throughout the whole process, okay? And likewise here, and hopefully others in terms of development rules will feel the same way, but, create this all for one and one for all attitude and get that buy-in. If you have a team, things are going to go much more smoother. There's going to be, greater participation, greater involvement again. And you're just going to have a, you're just going to be able to develop a better rule. Moving on here. Not only do you want, work group members that have experience and, are vested in the process and in the whole effort, okay, you need to be able to create and operate an efficient work group process. By that, I mean, develop a roadmap, okay? Identify identify all of the issues or as many as you can up front so you have a sense of where you're going to go, what you're going to take on in terms of what you're going to address as part of the rulemaking. Some people, I think a good idea that what we call an analytical blueprint. It's basically a document that lays out the soup to nuts of the problems, of the issues, and how you intend to take on these issues. It's something really worthwhile doing. Some rulemakings don't really necessarily, don't really require it, but I think it's really helpful in retrospect to develop such a blueprint. Okay. In terms of the work group process, what you want to do is establish clear responsibilities for work group members, and by that I mean, have them basically take the lead in the developing certain parts of the rule, developing issue papers, but make it clear that, who's going to do what. Otherwise, things will break down in terms of, just basically who's going to do what, I guess. And without that, things will just break down in terms of efficiency and effectiveness. You really need to be able to, identify who the responsibilities are and what they are, okay? Another thing is, as part of the an efficient and effective work process, you want to get your economic analysis team involved as soon as possible. There's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, they can identify problems with the options for particular issues, okay? They can, they're going to be basically pricing out the rule, okay? And some of the options can be outlandish in terms of the cost, and they could point that out to you really early on, and you might have to go back to the drawing board in terms of this option's not going to work because, as you move on through the process, you might have problems with your management in terms of this is just too expensive. You might have problems at OMB in terms of they're very interested in what the cost will be. And so they can help you, in terms of identifying, what the cost is going to be, what the problems might be with the particular options, okay? And then likewise, if they're experienced, they can offer suggestions in terms of, here's a better option that might, help you in terms of moving forward with this particular and solving this particular problem. Besides the economic analysis team, you want to get your lawyers and enforcement folks involved early. You know, again, the rule has to be legally defensible and enforceable. And without that, you know, you're sort of, you know, you're so, it's just impossible to move forward in terms of, you know, getting the rule out of the agency as well as getting it through OMB. Some other things to consider in terms of you know, creating and operating an efficient work group process. Okay, it really behooves, you know, the work group chair and, you know, to basically identify and monitor key deadlines and milestones and stick to them as best you can. The one thing you don't want to do is just keep on delaying and delaying. You need to monitor these deadlines and milestones because, again, it just delays the whole process. You know, learn to say no. I have a tough time saying that. I have somebody smiling at me as I say that. I have. I always say that my eyes are bigger than my stomach, and that is, I always want to keep on identifying and solving additional problems. But you really have to say no, because otherwise, the work group process will continue ad infinitum, and you just don't need that. You don't want it. You know, there's an art to listening. You really need to be able to listen to one another. Some people have a tough time in terms of being able to articulate a particular issue or problem. It's just the nature of the beast. But, you know, I think, you know, any work group chair as well as work group member has an obligation to truly listen to someone else, because maybe they might have a difficult time in terms of articulating what they're trying to say. But out of the babes, you know, come gems. And in this particular, and sometimes it may be that they have come up with a great idea, but you had to just listen a few times before it came through. And so, you know, I just think listening is just critical to a successful rulemaking effort. You know, as early on particularly, talk to stakeholders during the proposal stage to better understand current systems and problems. You got to get out there. You know, you have to understand. You have to understand how, what the implications are of the rule. You know, you need to, again, develop, you know, gather data. But you need to listen to folks in terms of where they're coming from, what those problems may be from those who have to comply with the rule. Yes, they can identify options, and you might have to take it with a grain of salt. But the point of the matter is they also can be helpful, too. So, you know, stakeholder involvement, I think, is really critical in terms of developing a really important rulemaking. Okay? I'm sorry, here a second. Hold it down. This is something that I've done a few times through the years, you know, use of a work group retreat. We did it recently with the hazardous waste generator rule. We brought in work group members from the regions. We spent a day and a half going through all of the issues that we had identified. What we did was we basically, in a day and a half, I would think we saved at least 3 or 4 months in terms of the work group process. I mean, the normal work group process is you have a meeting, and then you go back to the drawing board, and you spend a few weeks developing issue papers, one or more issue papers, then you have another work group meeting. And the weeks turn into months, and sometimes the months turn into years. But if you can have a work group retreat, you can cut down the months to days. And, you know, when we did this with the generator rule, I've done it with a couple of other rules. It's just if you can make it happen, make it happen. Because it's, you know, and not only that, but it's a great team-building effort, too. So I would recommend it in terms of if you can have a work group retreat. When I say get implementers involved early, by that I mean, among other things, there are folks who have to implement the rule. For instance, the RCRA info folks. When it comes to RCRA, you have people in the regions and states who have to implement the rule. They have to. It's just the record-keeping reporting requirements. You have to modify the forms. You know, you can't wait till after the rule is promulgated to get these people involved. You have to start early on because all of a sudden the rule is out there and people have to complete forms. And if they don't have, the necessary forms to complete, things come to a standstill. And then there's executive orders. Under the agency, you know, there's about 20 executive orders that you have to basically satisfy and comply with. And as an example, just to put in here a second, some of the more familiar ones for a lot of rule writers you know, is the economic analysis okay? And then there's the small business impacts aspect, the SBRIFA, that you have to deal with. But there's all other kinds of executive orders that you have to be able to respond to. There's the, as examples here, there's consultation and coordination with Indian tribal governments, protection of children from environmental health risk and safety risk. There's environmental justice in environmental in minority populations and low-income populations. I mentioned children's health. There's the Paperwork Reduction Act. So there's about 20 of these, and if, you know, you just have to address these executive orders one way or the other, because you know the rule won't get out of the agency or never mind OMB without addressing these executive orders. So moving on to point three here, issues, both real and perceived issues. You know, identifying and resolving key issues ahead of time if you can. And by that, I mean either before you have a work group meeting or before you go to work group closure. Work group closure is a key component of the work group process. It's where everything comes together, where various offices within the agency sort of give a thumbs up, a thumbs down in terms of whether they agree with the rule that you've developed. And so what you really want to be able to do as best you can is to resolve those issues, okay? Now, I mentioned here perception, where you sit is where you're at. And by that I mean, you know, a big issue to one work group member may not be the same for another office, you know, whether it be the lead office or others. It's just the nature of where you sit, okay? And so you have to be aware of that and try as best you can to work through the issues, listen to them in terms of where they're coming from, because, again, it's important to them. You know, they have no other, they may not have any other option in, other than sort of working with you in this rulemaking effort to get, you know, their issues, you know, through in terms of a rulemaking. Thing, okay, sometimes issues cannot be resolved. You can stay at it forever and ever, but you reach a point where it just can't be resolved at the work group level. And so anyway, you know, you might reach a point where you just have to, I'll call it cut bait, and agree to disagree and escalate. And what you're doing basically is you're going to your management in terms of, you know, sort of mentioning that the issue can't be resolved, and what you're doing is you're escalating and seeing whether they can work with their counterparts, my senior management can work with their senior management, and hopefully resolve the issue. Because the one thing you don't want to want to happen, hopefully, is that when you go to work group closure, you basically find an organization that gives you a thumbs down, they non-concur, in which case it really does pose problems in terms of delaying the process, delaying the rulemaking effort. And you know, basically at that point, it becomes very stressful in terms of getting senior management from different offices to try to work through the to work through the issues. What you really want to be able to do as best you can is, you know, strive for consensus. Okay? Okay. Now, point four, the rule writing process. What you really want to be able to do, and this is, I think this is pretty straightforward, but clear and simple rule language, you know, you want plain English. You know, it always works. I mean, you want the layman to be able to read this and understand it just like you did. Okay? You know, you want to be able to, you know, one idea is to be able to draft and review rule language together. It's nothing like being able to sit down as a group, as a team, to look at your draft rule text and work it through together in terms of trying to improve it. It's just much more efficient and effective if you can make that happen. Find a copy editor if you can. It makes a huge difference. I have somebody in the room who's very good at this, even though she won't admit it. But they can perform wonders in terms of, you know, making the process more efficient. Use a style sheet if you can. You know, develop a system to avoid, you know, versions control issues. You know, use a shared drive and cloud-based drive so everybody has the same documents at the same time that they can review. There was one other document here, I'm sorry. Yeah, I guess that's it. Okay. So I'm moving along here pretty fast, okay, because I know we're running out of time. So again, activities that you can't forget, you know, rule implementation, you know, again, as part of the rulemaking process, you got to think about rule implementation too. So as you're developing the rule, you're also thinking about communication materials and messages that you want to get across to your stakeholders. You want to think about any training and outreach you might have to do. Once the rule is proposed and promulgated, you might think about webinars. You might think about developing Q's and A's. Developing, you know, you might have to develop supporting guidance, just like I mentioned before, about sometimes supporting technical or policy guidances might be necessary. It also might behoove you to develop establish an EPA in the state users group to work through implementation issues. They're always, you know, I think it's a great idea to have these user groups. So you just can't forget this as well. And now some final thoughts, okay? Externalities, OMB. All I can say is that OMB can make you or break you. They have the power to slow things down. They can push back. They can, in my case, not so much my case, but I can remember years ago, they basically came back to us in terms of, well, you have a choice. You have two rules that you want to promulgate. You only can pick one, which is it going to be? And so I lost out. It was just the nature of the beast. But OMB has a lot of clout, and you have to just be aware of the fact that you're going to have to deal with them. And then there's competing agency and office priorities. As I said before, you know, you can be developing a rule, and you can be in competition with other rules. Again, you can, and they can, how best to say this, but you can have a situation where, you know, a rule can either be delayed or killed. And so you just have to be aware of the fact that there's only so much in the process that you can control. There's externalities or external factors, and you just have to be aware of them and basically deal with them as best you can. So some final thoughts here in terms of the keys to success, okay? And so to me, the bottom line is here is to create a great team and find consensus. Okay, if you have a great team, you're going to be able to work through the issues. You're going to be able to find consensus. If you find consensus, everything is going to go, you know, much more smoothly if, in fact, you run into key issues that you can't resolve. And so how best to say this is that other than you just can't go wrong, you know, if you can create a great team and find consensus, you're going to be successful. So there's a couple of other slides here, okay? These are some, you know, helpful resources for those who are in the rulemaking effort. You know, there's a few resources that I think would be very helpful. So, you know, there's links here to these sources. So they're useful, hopefully, if you, you know, have a chance to use them, or they may come into use. You know, again, I don't know whether we're able to pose this in terms of, I thought we saw some answers before, you know, in terms of, yeah, okay, great. So what did we say here, okay? So it looks like 7, it keeps on being modified here, but 7, I mean, over half the number of people who responded said all of the above. And I agree that, you know, all 1 through 6 are key ingredients, okay? But here's the other thing, okay? And not many people mentioned it, but I think number 8 is also something to consider, okay? Just being in the right place at the right time. You know, and it just is, and by that I mean, again, that you can do all of the above. You can have, you know, you can have, do the best in terms of defining a problem, staying out of the public eye, you know, having, you know, a vested work group and so on and so forth. But when all is said and done, there's only so much you can control in any work group process, and you have to be aware of that. So to me, I guess, you know, my answer would be it's a blend of both 7 and 8 in terms of, you know, what's the most important component of any rulemaking. But, you know, 1 through 6 you can control, but when it comes to externalities, You know, it's just the nature of the process. We live in a political process. Is the only I can put it. I hope that helps in terms of what my thoughts are. But you know, you're right. I mean, again, you know, 1 through 6 is really most. You know, every one of those is an important component of any rulemaking. Without any of them, you know, you're going to have a less successful, less effective rulemaking. So 1 through 6, yes. Okay, but just be aware of the fact that there's only so much, again, you can control. Can we go back in terms of what do we want to do? Okay. I think that's about it. I hope this helped, folks.
Yeah, thank you, Jim. So I know that this is Melissa, and I know that we're a little bit over on time, and some people will need to leave us now. I thought that we would go ahead for those that can stay on, take a few questions, and then you know, the recording will be posted on the CLUIN website, so people who have to leave early but are interested in the Q&A session can go ahead and look at the recording to get the answers to those. Does that work, Jim, if we just stay on a few more minutes?
Excuse me, hold.
Oh. Jim?
Melissa?
Yes.
Melissa?
Yes.
I think I have a conflict here in terms of, you know, I have the RIN call at 2 o'clock. And I am not sure, but apparently the RIN call might be listening into this conference. Which they're not supposed to be, I thought. So I don't know what to do other than I think we're going to have to call it quits. What people can do, Melissa, they can send me emails. You can send me the emails, and I'll be happy to answer, you know, any questions they might have on the presentation that I just gave, okay?
Okay, terrific. So thanks, everyone, joining today, and I apologize that we didn't get a chance to go through the Q&A. As Jim mentioned, I will go ahead and take your questions and forward them, and you also have Jim's email there on the front slide if you want to contact him directly. Just really briefly, we do have another one of these webinars coming up on September 7th, same time, same place. Kathy Baylor of Region 9 will be presenting Don't Forget the Well Keys, Lessons Learned from 25 Years of Fieldwork. So we hope that you'll join us again in a month's time. And thank you, Jim, for your time. And we hope to see you guys all again in a month. Thanks.
And one last reminder, please remember to fill out the feedback form for today's presentation. And enjoy